Pam Chambers on December the 1st, year 2000, interviewing Laszlo Jossa at his home at 3503 West 42nd.
That's correct.
Right. So Laszlo, I would like you to tell me, from our previous discussion, I know that Vancouver was not your original home, and it would be very good if you would tell us how your family came to be in Vancouver, and maybe even particularly how you came to choose Dunbar as a place to live.
Well, I came to Canada in 1957, in January of 1957. I was an 18-year-old university student from Hungary. I was an aftermath of the 1956 revolution. And I came with a group of university students from the city of Sopron. And we started our studies here at UBC at the Faculty of Forestry in September 1957. And I graduated in 1961. And because UBC is here on the Point Grey, on the west side of town, for practical reasons, we chose not to commute from Coquitlam or Mission. Mm-hmm. So we all settled in the west part of Vancouver. Mm-hmm. In fact, about 10 years later, someone very proudly proclaimed that he hadn't been east of Canby Street.
Oh, really? Well, having come so far, he didn't want to go any further, is
we
that
just
it?
Liked it here. We yeah, just liked it. Well. Had no reason to go back east.
Right. And that university was famous for its forestry faculty, which I believe moved here almost en masse, am I right?
About 200 students 200. Came with faculty and staff.
Yes.
And out of the 200 students, 141 graduated in forestry.
Mm-hmm.
And we had about a dozen professors and instructors, plus some administrative,
yes.
handful of administrative types. And of course, when we graduated, the thing ceased to exist.
Yes, yes. So by that stage, the next generation would be coming along and they would just merge into the
right.
UBC life,
that's right.
I think.
That's right.
But I think that those of us who've known about your migration know that you have added a great deal to our community, and you've raised a family here.
That's right.
Is your wife from from Hungary as
She's
well?
She's Hungarian born as well.
Uh-huh.
When she came, she was only 8 years old.
Uh-huh.
I just met her in Hungarian circles here in
mm-hmm.
Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And we married in 1966, and we have four children, two boys and two girls.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And my wife, Erica, is a school teacher, and we didn't have a family for the first 6 years of our marriage. Mm-hmm. So
she was...
She went to UBC as well, first in arts and then in education.
Uh-huh.
And then she taught for a few years. And then when we were raising the family, she stayed home with the kids. And when they sort of grew up, mm-hmm. they were school-aged, she went back into teaching.
Oh, is she teaching nowadays?
She's still teaching in kindergarten, teacher.
Whereabouts?
At St. Helens in Burnaby. It's a Catholic private school.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, that's quite a drive every day.
Well, fortunately, she's going against the traffic, so it's still a half an hour drive, yes.
Did it myself for 10 years teaching music.
Yeah.
So it has its own frustrations, that drive.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's interesting. And your four children, how old are they?
21 to 29.
Oh, yeah, so they're well grown up.
Well grown up.
You have them still at home, so?
Two of them are home, others are studying elsewhere.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, your own profession, you said you went to UBC, so what was your work?
When I graduated in 61, I worked in so-called dirt or practical forestry for 3 years. And after 3 years, I did this up in Prince Rupert, and the traveling got to be a bit too much, flying almost every second day. which was a great excitement for me, but the novelty wears off after a few years, and I switched over into a research and development field. I joined a pulp and paper company in Prince Rupert and worked in the research and development division, and I've been doing that ever since. And for the last 27 years, I've been working out at UBC for a company called Foreign Tech Canada Corp, Canada's Forest Products Research Establishment.
Yeah, I'll just write that down for
That's
the...
FORINTEK. Mm-hmm. It's an acronym for Forest Industry Technology.
Right. Mm-hmm. It helps the transcriber to jot some of these things down. Excuse me. So this was a line of work that you find very, very interesting.
Yeah, I found it very interesting. Mm-hmm. And as I say to my young colleagues who are new to Foreign Tech, I tell them you have to buy into the program to make it exciting. Mm-hmm. You know, dedicate yourself to your work, and it can be a lot of fun. You have to buy into it. Mm-hmm. And of course, the first thing you have to do as a neophyte, a new employee, you have to learn what is the status quo, mm-hmm. and how can you contribute. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to know where is the bar set, you know, before you can really jump into it and contribute. Yeah. But I've been quite fortunate. I enjoyed my work. Mm-hmm. In fact, I retired a year and a half ago officially, but I still work with the company as a consultant.
Right. And you were telling me that you also have an artistic background. It was something that's within yourself, and you have combined your professional life with your artistic life in a way.
That's right. I've been drawing. I've been drawing and painting all my life, ever since my first recollections. And what stays with me even today is how powerful of an influence it was of the positive feedback, how my parents' approval of doing, you know, copying from magazines and drawing, shading, staying inside the lines, you know, with the coloring, that it was kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, that you had approval and that encouraged you to do more, and you were approved again, and my art is rooted right back into my early childhood, and I've been doing it ever since, and I use that even in my professional life in terms of doing illustrations for my papers or my talks, mm-hmm. and even as a hobby, painting and sketching, and even wood carving.
Mm-hmm. Well, the illustrations that you have showed me in your book are really very striking. They're sort of dull pictures of tubes. Yeah. They're highly colored and very, very illustrative.
What have made sort of a real impact in my profession, mm-hmm. And I say this without having a big swollen head, I can say this objectively, is that the teaching aids that we have at university level in wood sciences, usually they are rooted back 30, 40, 50 years ago. Things haven't really changed much. And the structure of wood itself is such a complex thing to understand. Without three-dimensional models and without color-coded illustrations that classify, identify the individual cell types, you are in the dark. So in my work, I found that having the technical know-how and the artistic ability to express it, mm-hmm. you need this combination. Mm-hmm. Because you can be the most accomplished artist, but if you have no clue about the structure of wood, you can't put that message across. So this is what made a very good marriage, in my case, between my hobby and my profession, to this very day.
Yes. And so you're still engaged in doing some of
that. I still do a lot of training and education, giving workshops mm-hmm. to professional groups, professional foresters and woodworkers in BC.
Your son said when I phoned to make the appointment, yes, my father is semi-retired.
Yes. Yeah. But I'm probably more busy than ever before. I have a sense of, you know, that I want to do things while I still have the health and the energy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I waste very little time.
Yeah.
So I use the TV as a relaxation at the end of the day, but you wouldn't find me sitting through a hockey game from beginning to end. I think that's obscene, personally. But different strokes for different folks.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I have good friends that do sit through hockey games.
Yeah, yeah.
So and I certainly don't hold it against
them. Let them enjoy their thing.
Yeah.
What prompted me to come and interview you in particular is that because you are becoming very well known for what you've almost jokingly called your Hungarian totem poles, and which I have to tell you, I privately in my own mind thought, yeah, they're Hungarian totem poles. They're very visible in your yard, both front and back, and once you've seen them both on your property and at the shows that you show at, I think I recognize your gates in front of several people's houses in the west side of the city. So I'd like you to tell us more about those very distinctive Hungarian designs with which you've decorated your house and which you've taken out to share with the rest of the community.
Well, as I said, I have lived here now 43 years now, but my roots are unmistakably Hungarian, as is my heavy accent after so many years. But when I got into wood carving, subject matter is always a challenge to any artist, whether it's fabric art, watercolor, oil, or pottery. You know, what do you make and how big it will be? If you do a picture, a painting, a scene up in the mountains, you know, what comes onto the page? You know, what is that window that you are looking through? In the same sense, when I was doing decorative carvings first, I was trying to find out, you know, do I do Mexican geometric designs? Do I mimic West Coast native carvings? And the more I studied Hungarian folk art, the more affinity I had with it. I found some of the designs so perfect from books that I felt that it didn't need any improvement. And I sort of took to it like ducks to water. And for example, you were mentioning the Hungarian totem poles. They are so distinct and they are very elegant in their simplicity. You have maybe half a dozen design elements, and the way you combine them, they leave a very pleasant pattern, whether it's a letter opener handle or a two-meter-tall decorative garden ornament. Some of them I made into vertical water fountains or put a bird feeder up on top. And they are very, very pleasing to the eye. That's the best way I can put.
Yeah, they're very symmetrical, right?
Very symmetrical. And according to legend, these elements are based on the fighting weapons.
Oh, really?
Clubs and javelins in the Middle Ages when people were engaged in hand-to-hand combat. So when they had a club in their hand, to make them really effective, they would make them pointy and bumpy. And then, according to the sociographers, after the battle, they would bury the fallen victims, and they would take their weapons, whether it was a club or a javelin, and they would thrust it in the into the ground, you know, where they buried the victims as a grave marker.
Oh.
And in the last 200 years, they came up with a religious interpretation. The letter X is the initial of Christ's name in the Greek alphabet,
right.
And there is a spherical design that shows planet Earth with the equator running through it, and various execution of the tulip. Even though tulip is not native to Hungary, the Hungarians fell in love with the tulip, both in wood carving, embroidery, pottery. You can see tulip design all over.
So that was that part of that tulip mania when the tulips first came from?
That was something else. That happened in Holland, the tulip mania.
Yeah. Not so much in Hungary.
Not so much in Hungary. I think they probably couldn't afford one tulip bulb. I think with today's value, one tulip bulb would have to give 5 tons of wheat, 3,000 liters of wine, one Mercedes-Benz SUV. The value of one tulip bulb
was absurd, wasn't it? Yeah.
And just as it came, the tulip craze, it died just as quickly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But it lives on in this folk art. And a question I would like to ask, you mentioned that you looked at other ethnic art as a possibility for yourself, but did consciously go back to your roots. And I was wondering, like, is this a village art, or would you have been an urban person in Hungary already when you left? This art be all around you? I mean, it would just be a normal part of the decoration in the homes or the public buildings?
It was a normal part of life, particularly in places, where the forest was near the settlement, the village, or the city. And the way I really got drawn into the Hungarian folk art is I visited areas where it is still practiced today. Mm-hmm. And I had to travel to Transylvania. Mm-hmm. It's not as widely practiced in present-day Hungary because people have the good life. In other words, they don't have the time to do wood carving. Uh-huh. But in Transylvania, in present-day Romania, people don't have 2 cars in the front of the house and a TV with a VCR. Uh-huh. They are extremely poor. Uh-huh. And they use art as both enjoyment and passing, putting in time on long winter nights. So if you went into a small village like Spozon or like a town like Aldergrove, you would see literally hundreds, almost every house, the entrance to the house would have a carved gate, arched gateway, with a roof on top to protect the wooden elements. And they would be decoratively carved, particularly the surface visible from the street. Mm-hmm. And they would have a religious greeting, when it was built, who carved it. And most of them were fairly amateurish in their execution. But of course, in every settlement, there would be a handful, a dozen or two people that raised this to a very high level of professional competence. Mm-hmm. Very nice design. And I visited Transylvania, talked with people that do this, and so that's where the strong connection was reinforced.
And you've had a number of opportunities to go back then since.
I went back there only about 2-3 times, you can also find reference books, books on Hungarian art that have museum pieces, mm-hmm. and so it's a very there's a very deep well that you can go to.
And I think when we were talking off the tape, it was mentioned that you have not run into very many people here that are doing.
Not too many
people. What you are doing.
In fact, not too many people in BC do wood carving. I meet a lot of woodworkers through my professional life. Mm-hmm. I go to shows where they promote the secondary manufacturing. In addition to the native West Coast native art, there are some people that do chainsaw carving. There are some chip carvers, but I would say it's not very widely practiced, not as widely as it should be. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to overcome that by my own enthusiasm, time to impact other people.
Do some workshops through the Hungarian community?
I will be doing some workshops to the Hungarian communities.
And is this called chip carving?
Well, this would be, it could qualify as a chip carving. By definition, chip carving is when you remove small triangular shapes of wood, mm-hmm. in other words, wood chips. Mm-hmm. So this is not like a relief carving. Mm-hmm. But even the decorative garden gates that I carve, mm-hmm. they would fall into the chip carving category. Mm-hmm. Mind you, the chips you take out, they're quite large in size, and you would take it out by the incremental approach, not by one swell swoop, but gradually dig out, take away the extra wood. And the beauty of it is that you don't need expensive equipment or tools. Mm-hmm. Don't need any power tools. Basically, you can do just with one knife and a handsaw and a couple of clamps, to fix your work so it doesn't dance around when you work on it. Mm-hmm. So you could start up under $30.
Is that right?
So it's not like you need $1,000 or $2,000.
You get to Lee Valley Tools then.
Well, of course, Lee Valley Tools has a large part of my kids' inheritance because you can't leave without buying something. And there's always something a little wider, a little longer, a little sharper, a little shinier. So one does tend to collect tools. It's part of the part of the field, part of the occupational hazard.
Yeah, it's a fun place to visit, isn't
it? Yeah, it's very nice.
Yeah. So, when are they going to feature your work on a cover?
I haven't approached them about that, but there will be one major involvement with my wood carving. That will be the second Hungarian festival coming up in early February 2001. Mm-hmm. We will have a two-day exhibit at the Roundhouse Community Center. And they asked me to feature my carving, and I will be demonstrating how to make small decorative wall hangings, how to carve one of these Hungarian totem poles, mm-hmm. and I will be working on one of the gate posts, mm-hmm. Just to show people that if I can do it, anyone else can do it, mm-hmm. working on small, medium, and large scale pieces, mm-hmm. and I will be talking about the structure of wood, choices of wood that one has available in BC, considering both the technical property of the wood and the price you have to pay for the wood. Because even in Vancouver, where we have a very rich wood source in British Columbia, it can cost you close to $1,000 just for the wood to carve one of these small garden gates.
Is that right? Yes. Well, no, I can believe that. There's a lot of wood.
Well, it's not so much the quantity, but the quality.
The best, yeah.
So if you get edge green, clear yellow cedar, you have to pay $7 a board foot, even though the lumber market is very soft today. Lumber is selling around $200 a thousand board feet. This is the bellwether of the forest products industry in BC. Spruce, pine, fir, two and better sells for $210 US today, 1,000 board feet. So to compare my wood for the gate, it would cost me $7,000, 1,000 board feet, instead of 210. So it's a very valuable wood, but there are alternatives.
So a garden gate like that is made with yellow cedar.
This one in the front of my house is made of yellow cedar. Mm-hmm. The one I have on the side entrance to our house, I made that out of spruce, and I paid one-tenth the price. So instead of paying $750 for the wood that went into the posts and the beam, I paid only $75. But I have to say that...
How long has it been standing, and how long do you expect it to stand?
The gates that I pressure treat will be standing for 100-plus years easily.
Really?
And even the ones that are not pressure treated... if you have a good footing, if the wood is not allowed to stand in dirt and water, if you have the good drainage at the base and you have the roof on top protecting the wooden elements, there's no reason that even an untreated gate could stand for 200 years. Those are the ones I saw in Transylvania. The earlier ones with a date carved onto them, they go back to 1816, so that's nearly...
Do you carve a date in yours?
I put most of them. I put on, although I don't expect they will be around for 200 years.
No.
Most likely for 300 years.
Yeah.
I tend to make a hobby, a habit of having outdoor pieces pressure treated for longevity. Mm-hmm. For example, we have a planter box in our living room window, and I carved that 24, almost 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. Because it is pressure treated, it looks as if I put it out yesterday. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the pressure treating chemical protects the wood mm-hmm. from the harmful ultraviolet rays from the sunlight. So that's why it still looks as if it were brand new.
And this is not something that you can do yourself here.
No, it has to be done. To a treating plant.
A treating plant.
And they do it, it's not very expensive at all.
Uh-huh.
And once you do it, you don't need to paint it. There is no better finish for wood with today's technology than pressure treating with chromated copper arsenate that tends to make the wood sort of a greenish color. Mm-hmm. You can see that on telephone posts, fence posts.
Yeah, you can see it on the fence posts that have an ordinary fence replacement. Yeah.
It would be actually irresponsible not to have them treated, because without treating, you have to replace the fence post in 10, 15 years, particularly in our climate. But with pressure treating, it lasts 50, 60 years.
Mm-hmm. 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 I mean, just being through some fence post replacement of my own, I'm sort of aware of the pitfalls.
Usually the materials are not expensive, it's the labor.
Yeah.
So I think that's a big sort of improvement in all our attitude towards wood. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you want to be good to planet Earth, mm-hmm. we shouldn't be using less wood, we should use more wood.
Really?
Of course.
Elaborate on that. That's interesting.
But this is the only material known to man that you can grow back. You can't grow back copper. You can't grow back aluminum, steel, plastics. These are finite global resources. Mm-hmm. And what is even more harmful when you look into it a little deeper, extraction, mining, smelting these materials leave a huge environmental footstep on planet Earth because of the fossil fuels that you need to extract and manufacture and adding to the greenhouse gases. So when professional, credible scientists do comparisons between wood and steel, concrete, and other building materials, wood comes out by far ahead of all these other materials in how much energy you use in extraction, erection of the building, or even recycling. Mm-hmm. So this is renewable.
It is fairly slow to regenerate, though, in human life terms, isn't it?
That's not a problem, particularly when you look at it from the Canadian perspective or from the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we have the best timber growing conditions anywhere on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. We have excellent climate, excellent soil, and we can have in the lower mainland, we could have trees in a harvestable size in 7 years.
Seven.
These are the hybrid poplars.
Hybrid.
That they grow up in the Fraser Valley on the floodplains of the Fraser. In fact, I saw on the main drag on Fraser Highway in Alder Grove, instead of seeing raspberry plantation, I see hybrid poplar plantation.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And this is used for making tissue paper, mm-hmm. making pulp on a very short rotation. Mm-hmm. But here on the coast, we actually already harvest Douglas fir at age 45, 50 mm-hmm. today. Mm-hmm. And of course, we also harvest 1,000-year-old trees. But we have a very good climate, very good choice of tree species. And if anyone has any reservations still, I have a recipe for these folks. I ask them to, in their mind's eye, get into their car, drive up to Vanderhoof. It will be a long day's drive. Mm-hmm. Then you hole up in a hotel or a motel, and next day you get up in the morning, get into your car, and drive due west on a logging road for 2-3 hours. And then I want this person to get out of the car, look around, and ask the following question: what better could you do with BC, the BC landmass, than growing trees? There's plenty of ground out there. But I'm afraid the land is gripped by the green religion. You know, I think it's. I'm not suggesting we should be raping and pillaging. We should use wood with intelligence, and we should harvest and plant the new forest with good understanding, good use of the scientific principles.
Is that opinion beginning to make headway or prevail in any way?
There's a problem with the forest products industry in general. They are not very good at giving the good news. And what is even more troublesome, good news don't sell in the paper or on the nightly news. Controversy always acts like a magnet, and everything is magnified. But I can tell you, as I work with professional foresters and secondary manufacturers, people are committed to good forestry in BC, and good harvesting, good manufacturing. It's a very important part of our economy, and will be so.
Yes.
You know, the industry has very good paying jobs, and it's going to survive for many years to come. And some experts even suggest that we are in the space age now. We came through the industrial age, you know, the stone, bronze, iron, and there's a new age around the corner, and that will be the age of wood.
That is very interesting.
That it's such a good, not only that, but when you go into a steel, glass, concrete, steel, glass building, it feels very cold. But when you go into a building that has wood in it, it feels good. And I think people are coming back to wood more and more.
I've noticed that, just coming back to your art, which is an outgrowth of your profession in wood, that your works are in a new retail outlet down on Granville Island, which is dedicated to the added value working of wood. I've said that clumsily, but...
No, you got it right. There's a...
Do you think that's going to succeed? Has it got a good hope of succeeding that?
Indeed. That store on Granville Island is the BC Woodworkers Co-op store. And all the people that make or work with wood in British Columbia, there are only two caveats, you know, for you to show your work and sell your products in that store. One is that you have to belong to a co-op. You have to be a co-op member.
Oh,
and
see.
It costs only $25.
Yeah? Uh-huh.
The second one is that the quality of your work has to meet a certain minimum standard.
It is juried.
Actually, there's a movement afoot to have dozens of these stores across BC.
Oh, really?
And we are envisioning having these stores at Tawasson, Horseshoe Bay, Nanaimo, Victor, tourists, you know, where there's a lot of foot traffic.
Mm-hmm.
The co-op store on Granville Island is a resounding success. You know, that if you go there, I just talked with a colleague of mine who goes there visiting quite frequently. And he says every time he goes, there is new stuff in there.
Yeah.
And the reason is that because people tend to buy things, so we bring in new things.
Yeah.
So my work got into it because the lady running the store thought that the pieces I had were so different that it would add to the store atmosphere, because we are trying to use the diversity of products, not only the choice of BC woods, but the kind of things that you can make.
So that's
not only 500 coffee tables and nothing else, but we have bird feeders, dining room tables.
That executive desk is enormous, right?
Yeah, very nice.
That word.
Yes, that executive desk. In
India.
So I think there will be more. And this is something that the BC government is doing on a conscious level. No doubt everyone has heard of the Forest Renewal British Columbia, FRBC, and there is they have discovered long ago that we have to go beyond the primary manufacturing sector. Mm-hmm. In other words, when we take 1 cubic meter of wood, we have to sort of slow down with that cubic meter of wood and do more with it than what we do presently. We hear on the nightly news almost people are upset about log exports. Mm-hmm. In other words, we are exporting jobs. You know, when we export building materials, dimensional lumber, you know, there's some manufacturing already, but the ultimate is the high value added when an artisan makes a $5,000 headboard that you feel that it's worth it because it's so exquisitely made,
yeah.
Or a $6,000 heirloom dresser, mm-hmm. or a sideboard or whatever have you. And I think we see sort of the birth of the high value added sector in BC. It is being encouraged, and it is even taught at a university level, advanced wood manufacturing.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the jobs that the graduates have will be well paying jobs, mm-hmm. and they will have a choice, they can pick and choose.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something new in British
Columbia. And certainly work they can have pride in.
Yeah, and it's something that everyone should know about, but it's good news, doesn't sell too well.
Well, anyway, I was pleased to see it when I came across it. It was in the paper. It was in the news.
Yeah, it was advertised.
It was,
and
in a news story, yeah.
And also when people go there by word of mouth,
yeah.
I think there will be... it will be a resounding success.
That's great. Should we take a breather here?
Sure.
I liked your analogy of this process of interviewing as tapping the tree to get the sap, and later on we have to boil it down. Now you have some comment further on.
That's right.
After that,
I was saying that the maple syrup, which is an interesting. Factoid that when you eat maple syrup, you are eating the building blocks of wood.
Oh, yeah.
This is what the sugar maple uses as a raw material, the energy source for making cellulose in lignin, making solid wood. So in the same sense, you know, this interview process is the